Right now we're speaking with Jim Walsh. He's an award-winning journalist and songwriter who's written for City Pages, Pioneer Press, Village Voice, and even Rolling Stone. He's got a book out called Gold Experience, Following Prince in the 90s, and he's here to talk about it. Welcome, Jim.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I'm excited to talk about this book. So one of the things that struck me right away is the intro. You kind of talk about your experience on the day that Prince passed away, kind of where you were and what you were doing. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I was, I write about it in the introduction because I just say that, you know, Prince, it was fitting that I was on my way to my regular basketball game that day with my son, and we were driving and we had the radio down low, and I could hear the gravity in the DJ's voice, and you could just tell something was up. So I turned the volume up, and it was Jade on the Current here in Minneapolis, and, you know, she confirmed that Prince was dead. And I turned around, I turned the car around, and I said to him, I said, you know, I patted him on his basketball shorts, and I said, sorry, dude, I got to work. And I wrote a, you know, in about an hour, hour and a half, I wrote a very fast eulogy, and for Minpost, I was writing for Minpost at the time, you know, wept along with the world. That night, I do a thing here in Minneapolis called the Mad Ripple Hootenanny, and it's a songwriter sort of weekly round robin. And that night we just, you know, we probably played five Prince tunes that night. And I played one tune of mine in particular that just left me weeping at the end. And after that went down to the Kitty Cat Club, kind of caught a whiff of all of what was happening at First Avenue, and saw a friend's band at the Kitty Cat Club. And I just basically went fetal, you know, all weekend. And then I wanted to see more of you know, what I had collected over the years of covering Prince when I was at the Pioneer Press. And so I went down to my, you know, my basement and dug around in some boxes of memorabilia that I have, and I found some cool stuff, including a cool little love letter he sent to me around 1998, I think it was. And it just said, "Peace and be wild." And I had never seen it before. Or to my knowledge, I didn't remember. You know, when someone dies, you just are like, you want to hold everything close. Like, what do I have? What did he give me? Or what? And that was a sweet little, you know, message from beyond. And from there, I very much wanted to see everything that I wrote about in the 90s, because I covered him really hard and very passionately and, you know, thoughtfully as a beat. None of that stuff is online, or very, very, very little of it.
You might have a unique experience in a lot of those situations then.
Yeah, right. I mean, I started looking around, and the St. Paul Pioneer Press has virtually no archives available. And in fact, when I was doing the book, I said, "Can I have the library?" I was checking on something, and this woman laughed and said, "We haven't had a library for years." A newspaper, you know, without a library. So that was incredible. And I, there's a site called newslibrary.com, and I just basically, over the course of about 3 weeks, just bought all my clips back from that, because that does record it, but it's a paper download service. I got all of it back. And I threw it at my editor at the University of Minnesota Press, who I had just finished doing a book, a collection called Bar Yarns and Manic Depressive Mixtapes, and it's a collection of my writings, music writings, over the last 30 years. And so I was in archival mode already, and I knew this stuff existed, and I knew there were cool reports from, you know, down at Glam Slam at 3 a.m. or Erotic City at 3 a.m. and Paisley Park at 6 a.m. and, you know, Target Center and First Avenue and everything. So that's the book. The book is called Gold Experience. After the he had me write the liner notes to his terrific 1995 album, The Gold Experience. And, you know, I was honored to do that. And, you know, I've said it before. At the time, I just felt like I was covering this underground band, this, you know, this artist who had fallen kind of out of the, you know, the trendy pop music charts. Even in Minneapolis, people were just sort of like, yeah, Prince is old news, to a degree, not entirely. But he made great records. He was very prolific, and he played a lot in town. And I sometimes felt like I was the only one writing about it or going to these shows, unlike, you know, when the current got up and running. And that was a great thing for both parties, because Prince, in a very old school way, you know, he had a new single and he'd get it to the current right away, and, mm-hmm. and they had a groovy thing going. And the book came out in January, and it's been bittersweet, because I've doing interviews like this and doing a lot of readings and talking to Prince fans, and sure wish he was here instead of me and you.
Yeah. I think we're all feeling that same thing. So, yeah. So what sets the 90s apart from other eras of Prince? What makes that distinct?
Musically, you know, at the time it was a time of grunge and hip hop ruling the airwaves, and it was pre-internet too. And so musically it was, you know, it was Prince. It was, much of it was, can stand up with all of his storied hits. And yet the way the music industry functions, it just, you know, it doesn't always hear it, much less play it or sell it. Prince was at the beginning of his war with Warner Brothers in the 90s too. He wrote Slave on his face. He changed his name from Prince to the Love Symbol, because he didn't want to be constrained. And he didn't want to be constrained by a corporation that was telling him when he could release music. And, you know, he had a vision of the future that was very clear. It was the dawn of the internet, and he knew that he could be his own distribution network and record label. I mean, he already was his own record label with MPG Records. But, you know, Chance the Rapper just is on a worldwide tour right now, and he went through zero music industry portals. You know, he is an independent artist, much in the way that Prince envisioned it. And, you know, somewhere Prince is having a laugh. He trailblazed that for sure.
Ready or not, here I come.
That is Let It Go, all one word, from the 1994 Prince album Come. And we're talking about Prince in the 90s with Jim Walsh, the author of Gold Experience, Following Prince in the 90s, a new book about the Purple One himself in that decade that just came out earlier this year. Jim Walsh is a music journalist from the cities who got to follow him a lot during those years. This is the era where he was frequently changing his name and using the now iconic Love Symbol. And Jim says that some people then didn't know how to react to that.
People thought he was very, they didn't understand why someone would write Slave on their face or change their name. And, you know, he was an artist and he was fighting for his freedom all the time.
I was going to comment on that. Like, what was kind of the public opinion of Prince at the time? Did they think he was vulgar or less vulgar or more vulgar than he had been perceived in the past?
I don't know, man. I mean, it's, you know, you listen to Dirty Mind and, you know, you listen to, you know, Controversy and and 1999 and even Purple Rain, you know, it's like the 80s, man, you know, were, you know, that stuff was on the radio. Very sexy, sexual music that was going against the grain and the very, very politically conservative and socially conservative 80s. It was very welcome. You know, he and Madonna and, you know, post-punk rock stuff and the rise then of hip-hop and grunge. So, no, I mean, in the 90s, yeah, I mean, I write about the Endorphin Machine, you know, which was his big stage that he had out at Paisley Park. And, you know, hell of it's not like a gold-plated vagina in the grand tradition of, you know, all sorts of acts before him. So, was he as raunchy? Sure. Yeah, for sure. You can look it up.
So one comment that really struck me in your book was you talk about, just briefly, kind of about the feminist aspects of some of his lyrics. So some might think that they were overly sexual, but you kind of thought that wasn't the case, that they're more positive.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, the gold experience itself starts out with P control, and that's very much, you know, he meant for that to be as, you know, a feminist manifesto, kind of, you know, as only he can do it. And it's for sure he had that in mind. And it's one of the few feminist manifestos that you're able to see exotic dancers dance to. So, and that's been the case since it came out. So I know that for a fact. Starts off the gold experience.
And is that album, the one that you named the book after, is that kind of where you think Prince kind of found himself again or kind of got revitalized?
I don't think he was ever unvitalized or
that's
whatever
the
word is. I don't know. I mean, honestly, I think he would say that. You know, I mean, in the intro to the book, I say, you know, I was rooting for him. You read those clips back and you just go, I was rooting for him. I was going, come on, man, come on, come on, come on. And did that make me less of an objective observer? Not really, because it's music. But I think in covering him in the 90s, I read so many reviews, and since Purple Rain, you read reviews saying this is a return to Prince's glory days. This is a return for Prince. This is the best thing he's done since blank. And I think that he would tell you that he never, quote unquote, lost it. Up until the day he died, you know, he was, you know, I saw him at Paisley Park the last time he played for his first piano and a microphone show. And it was brilliant. And you could tell that was coming next, you know, that he would, you know, he would probably make a record that way, mm-hmm. and tour for sure, theaters or clubs. And that was very exciting. So the gold experience was, though, a cut above, and it was the last record for Warner Brothers. It had his last number one hit on it, which was The Most Beautiful Girl in the World. And, yeah, telling that it's not being reissued by Warner Brothers or streaming on Spotify. Very telling, I think.
I'm going to go back a bit to what you said earlier, because you actually mentioned a quote that I just pulled out. We're talking about rooting for him. There's a section here where you wrote a note or like a letter to Prince kind of talking about, you know, do you even want another number one hit? And you had this conversation with him, actually, and the conversation mm-hmm. with Prince in this book are terrific. And he says, no, 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 I've been to the mountaintop. There's nothing there.
It's true. That's what he said. And I thought that was so wise, you know, what a wise thing to say about fame and success. He wasn't complaining about it, but he was just saying there's nothing there. And I thought that was really smart. Yeah, he was bugged at me about that column, though.
You kind of really tore into him, I'll be honest.
It was with love. It was brotherly love. That's what it was.
Was that kind of the vibe when you guys chatted? Was it very, you know, friendly, jovial, not so much like a guru experience? Or?
Oh, for sure. I mean, it was surreal because it was for 2 hours and he just read my column back to me line by line. We're talking about here, I wrote a column around his birthday. He was having a celebration out at Paisley Park. And I said, dude, how about if we get a great new record from you? We haven't gotten anything for like 3 years. And he did not like that. So, and yet, you know, we had a groovy thing going. So he felt comfortable enough or whatever enough to call me up and say, let's talk about this. And I went out that Friday to Paisley Park, and he and I and Larry Graham and I had a lovely chat for a couple hours. And it was very funny and jovial and spirited and, you know, I can't even remember what we all talked about, but it was cool. And I regret that that's not going to happen anymore. I regret that, I never got to play him one-on-one in basketball. Like we threatened to do that a couple of times and it never happened. And in fact, I just had a conversation. I introduced Maite, his former wife, at her reading. She's got a book out called Most Beautiful. And I introduced her at the university club last week. And her and Prince's bodyguard was there. And I was talking to him before the reading. And he said, the one thing about playing Prince in basketball and horse, nobody ever beat Prince. Because you get in the last letter and you go, you're gonna make that, you're gonna shoot that, and just like intimidate people and go like, so no one ever lost, or Prince never lost to anyone, which is a That's hilarious so little tidbit.
I was almost gonna say that in true Prince fashion, did he spell horse a different way that would only make him win?
Yeah, he probably had little rules.
Yeah,
that's funny.
It was a different horse symbol or something.
I would have exactly. Or Little Red Corvette had to be blaring in the background, and you'd be singing it, and you'd be, yeah. I would have done it. I would have buried threes at him. I'd go, no, man, you got to make it. Come on, no.
You can play with Larry Graham, too.
You get two.
You could play with Larry Graham, too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's about that walk. That's Prince from The Vault, Old Friends for Sale. It's a collection of songs released in 1999 by Warner Brothers, some songs that he had recorded back when he was still with that record label. In 1999, he had already moved on to recording on his own New Power Generation and EMI Records, and would later go on to sign with Arista. Speaking of 1999, that's a very important year. I asked our guest today, Jim Walsh, the author of Gold Experience, Following Prince in the 90s, about what happened when the year of the song finally came to be.
Not much. I mean, it was out there, and I think, you know, certainly, I mean, I wrote that piece going into it, going like it was in late December 1999. I go, wow, here we go, you know, can you believe it? And as I remember, you know, I mean, it was at parties and stuff. It was played on the radio, and Warner Brothers reissued it as a single, I think. But I don't think he ever really did anything with it that year.
I vaguely remember there being like a cover version that kind of charted at that time. Like I was 10 years old. I don't really remember. Maybe I'm just misremembering it. Do you know?
I think you're right. I think there was this would have, you know, infuriated Prince. I think there was like a mashup or something, or a dance version that Warner Brothers released, you know, at the end of 98. Okay. Something like that. Yeah.
All right.
You're right.
Mm-hmm. I got to look into that. This has been bugging me for like 15 years. So,
right on.
And you go into detail about a lot of different concerts that you saw. So what was the best concert that you saw Prince do, either in the 90s or just overall?
I always return to, I write about it in the book, and it was extraordinary. 1997, the Target Center, he played two nights, and then in between those two shows, two arena shows, he played an unbelievable, like, 3 or 4 hour thing at Paisley Park that we all went home at 6 in the morning, or we all, like, 100 people. And then he played Target Center that night. That was just phenomenal in terms of full-on funk. But those shows at First Avenue, because of where they were and because of his ascent in the 80s, you know, I saw him around Dirty Mind. I saw him at his very first show at Sam's, later First Avenue. And the one that I loved was... played two nights kind of rehearsing his band for the Sign of the Times tour. And, God, that band was just so fun and funky and big and cool. That was amazing. And I loved that band in the 90s, the New Power Generation, that I wrote so much about. Tommy Barbarella, Sonny Thompson, Michael Bland and Morris Hayes and Maite, and they delivered some just incredible shows. So, yeah, I mean, if we're doing sports talk, sure. You know, I would say the Purple Rain show at First Avenue, and, you know, the Sign of Time show at First Avenue, 97 Target Center and Paisley Park. But, you know, that doesn't include stuff, you know, like Erotic City Nights at Glam Slam. I saw incredible shows at Glam Slam too. So those, those eight or whatever it was.
Just reading this and kicking myself now. I only lived in Minneapolis for like not even a year, actually. I lived in St. Cloud before that and then moved up here. So I never got to see Prince. And
yeah. Tough, I know. Well, and that's why I put this book together, because there's real, actual history in that book that would have... I was very fevered putting it together. I was like, you know, Prince is my age, and these stories are going to die with me. So I want to make sure that they exist, and I'm thrilled that University of Minnesota Press agreed.
Is there anything he did in that era that the book covers, kind of 90 to about 2002? Is there anything he did there that you felt was like a really bad move for him or very disappointing?
I remember when he pulled out from Saturday Night Live like 2 days before, you know, it was kind of a big deal. It was exciting. Prince was going to be on Saturday Night Live, and, you know, that's still a pretty good gig, even if Saturday Night Live has lost some of its cachet. It's still, you know, that's what most people watch musically on a Saturday night still in America. That was a drag. But other than that, you know, no, I can't think of anything that really, you know, and that's the part where you're rooting for an artist and, he does something like that. It's tough to, be a fan sometimes.
So now looking back, it's 2017, and, even after his passing, is there anything from your time with him that sticks out even more now than it did back then? That really stuck with you?
All of it, frankly. I really did not think that... I mean, it's precious to me. That's why the book's important, because he was brilliant. And I was happy to chronicle a lot of that. And both him as a musician and as a thinker and business person, too. It was very special. You know, I feel very lucky to have lived through that time and to have taken such exhaustive notes. And interviewing him, too, you know, those three interviews that I have with him in the book are, you know, they're funny little tidbits as only Prince, and wise, funny and wise and informative, so...
He gave you some very cryptic answers to a lot of your questions, too.
He did, yeah, right. I have that we did an interview by fax once, and I have that, and it's very funny to see the little eye icons and the smiley. He did a little smiley face after a while, you know. So it's pretty funny.
I've heard rumors that when he came out with the love symbol, there were actually like things you could download or had on floppy disk that you could upload.
Yep.
Is that a real thing?
Yeah, I have a floppy disk. Yeah, I have it. You know, he sent it out. It's hilarious.
A little thing so you too can type with love symbol.
And he wanted who said this? I read this in an interview. I think it was Jesse Johnson, I think, said that he did not understand why he wanted all the typewriters, all the keyboards all over the world to have that symbol on it. And Jesse Johnson, and he just said to Jesse Johnson, it just flummoxed him, like, well, why can't we make that happen? Jesse Johnson also said that he went over to Prince's house one day, and the pots and pans that he put in his dishwasher, they were all face up, and he just goes, man, what are you doing? You got to put your pots and pans face down. And he said, that's the dude I knew. That's what Jesse said. That was very funny.
That's terrific.
It might, and I was thinking that maybe that inspired the song "Face Down" off of Crystal Ball.
Oh, wow.
Chaos and Disorder, yeah.
Or Breakfast Can Wait.
Or no,
and
it, yeah, right. Wait, no, Face Down is on Emancipation.
Right. Oh, yeah, that was the one after Warner Brothers.
I mean, you know, the thing is that's very interesting about this, too, is like, again, going back to the current, on the one-year anniversary, you know, they did an 89 some best Prince songs.
Mm-hmm.
There is not a single song reflected of those 89 songs from any of those records in the 90s. And I think that's telling. It's either telling about, I mean, are those listeners saying that they didn't matter? All those records like Come and The Gold Experience and Chaos and Disorder and Emancipation and The Truth and, you know, five more. There's nothing on those. I mean, that's what you're talking about when you're talking about Prince. Stuff goes undiscovered. There's underground everything because he was so prolific.
Mm-hmm. Despite his popularity, I can totally get that.
Right, right. Yeah. It's incredible.
That's why we're here.
Yeah, right on. Well, and that's why the book exists. It's like, you know, there's a whole decade there that felt like an underground band. More so, I think, than the 2000s and double aughts, you know, and tens, you know, because the internet was up and running then, and the current, and you knew what Prince was doing, but man, it felt like I was covering, you know, a band that played the 7th Street Entry or something. So that's a little bit of an exaggeration, but it was definitely a somewhat overlooked time in his career.
Well, we're very glad that you were around to capture it and get this book together. It
cool.
is The Gold Experience on University of Minnesota Press, Following Prince in the 90s. Jim Walsh, the author and music writer, and Mad Ripple Hootenanny, ringleader, he's with us today. Jim, thank you so much for talking.
Thanks for having me, and Prince forever, baby.
I'll remember that. I'll never forget that. I think that's the last line in the book, actually.
Peace and be wild. Yeah, right on.
All right, thank you, Jim.
Thanks, man. Cheers.